When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back once again to Dirty Sexy History. My name is Jess, and I live in the present. Sometimes. Allegedly. Well, when you study history, like so many of us do, it's easy to become preoccupied with the past at the expense of the present. But the deeper you look into things, the more parallels you find. This is something I've always tried to highlight on this show, making those connections to bring history to life in a way that you can relate to. And today's episode really brings that home. I am talking to clinical psychologist Dr. Eric Sprankel about the history and science of masturbation. This conversation feels really current, and that's because it is. People have been wrestling with the ethics, science, and theology of masturbation for centuries, and we are still having the exact same conversation today. This is a science-heavy episode, but we do talk about different historical thoughts on masturbation, especially in American history. Last month, we talked to Hallie Lieberman about vibrators, and today we're talking to Eric about Kellogg's cornflakes, graham crackers, bizarre conspiracy theories about porn, and the founding father who thought studying math would keep you from ringing the devil's doorbell. Eric's new book is DIY, The Wonderfully Weird History and Science of Masturbation, and it comes out on Tuesday, so you still have time to get those pre-orders in. I loved the book every bit as much as I loved this conversation, and I hope that you check it out. So without further ado, here's my interview with Dr. Eric Sprankel. All right, everybody. My guest today is clinical psychologist Dr. Eric Sprankel, author of DIY, The Wonderfully Weird History and Science of Masturbation. Eric, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
It is such an honor to have you. I can't tell you how much I enjoyed this book. So you've been hailed by a number of publications as a masturbation expert. How does that feel?
Yeah, it fits. But seeing some of the comments on Twitter, I think it was Slate that said that most recently, everyone was chiming in and be like, well, I'm a masturbation expert too. And be like, yeah, you probably are. I think that's one maybe misperception that could be out there, that the book is like a how-to or even kind of self-help, and it's not really that. It's on the science, it's on the history, but masturbation expert, it fits. I'll take it.
Yeah, absolutely. As someone who is an expert in venereal disease, I do have some sympathy.
Right.
You mentioned ruining dinner parties with talking about masturbating fetuses, and
right.
I usually ruin them by talking about tertiary syphilis. So I feel like we should team up,
too.
You know? We could do some damage.
Right.
Yeah. So in this book, you cover a lot of truly bizarre theories about the consequences of masturbation. And what I'm trying to get at here, do I need to worry about having mermaid offspring in the undersea world?
Yeah, that was a fun guy. He was a pastor in Uganda who wrote a blog about all the reasons why Christians shouldn't masturbate. And yeah, he believed it was the only time that I ever saw this like mermaid mythology come into the picture in my research, believing that masturbation creates mermaids in the sea. But no, you do not absolutely have to worry about that. You do not have to worry about most things that are blamed for or a result of masturbating. There is a little bit of a nuance to that, and it's kind of ironic, and it is a self-fulfilling prophecy, is that you kind of do have to worry about the effects of masturbation if you worry about the effects of masturbation. And that's kind of like the clinical perspective of, and what the research really documents, is that those who have unhealthy attitudes toward masturbation, who think it's a sin, who thinks it's immoral or unhealthy in some way, but do it at least occasionally, yeah, they can feel a lot of distress afterwards, and it can lead to relationship conflicts if their partner isn't cool with them masturbating. And so in those instances, yeah, masturbation's not the greatest, but it's not masturbation that's actually causing it. It's the attitudes and the values about masturbation. But for the rest of us, if you have a healthy attitude toward masturbation, it's your body, do as you please.
Yeah, absolutely. And one thing that most of the kind of major world religions have in common is this opposition to masturbation. So why is this, and where does that come from?
Very simply, it's just, and I was actually surprised by how simple this explanation is across the major religions. And that's just that the genitals are designed by God for one very narrow, specific purpose, and that's to express marital love with the hope of procreation through penile vaginal intercourse. So any sexual behavior beyond that, which pretty much includes every sexual behavior except for one, that's considered a sin or frowned upon by God in some way, if sin's not part of the language of a particular religion. And that's it. And so masturbation is really not unique in that. And so, but masturbation falls under that umbrella of being sexually immoral. There is also some argument that's it's a little, it's indirectly related to this. And so you go back to the story of like Onan and the fable of Onan with like wasted seed. And sometimes that's pointed to as an explicit example of biblical prohibition against masturbation. And that's not really the case. The fable's more about family duties, procreation, and essentially just obeying what God tells you to do. That's the fable of the story. But indirectly, it is about not wasting seed. And so then that can turn into a lot of different rules surrounding masturbation and a whole host of other sexual behaviors as to not waste the seed outside of an intentional act of procreation.
Yeah. And the story of Onan comes up a lot in these different kind of documents that people are producing throughout history, talking about kind of the dangers of masturbation.
Yeah, with Onanism specifically, I mean, that's just the story of Onan, whose brother was killed by God for like this undisclosed wickedness. They don't go into details of what he actually did, but enough to piss off God. It was like, you're dead. And now his brother, the dead guy now, he had his wife, and so she's a widow now. And God commanded Onan to be with her and have children with her in order to keep his dead brother's bloodline alive and well, and so it would actually be his brother's birthright. And Onan didn't really like that idea. I mean, he was fine fucking his dead brother's wife, but he didn't like the idea of his children not being his own birthright. I mean, biologically they would be his, but they wouldn't be in terms of like an heir, it wouldn't actually be his. It would be his deceased brother. And so what he would do at the timing of orgasm, he would withdraw his penis and, quote, spill his seed upon the ground. And that pissed off God. And God killed him for that. So that's the fun biblical family story.
So you actually also have a graduate research team investigating satanic sexuality. So what have you found with this?
Yeah, the Satanist research was fun to start, and it was kind of a goof to start. It was about 5 years ago or so. I made some national news for some tweets, and along with that were some shared photos that I also have on social media of some satanic decorations I have around my house. And so a lot of right-wing news organizations started referring to me as like a satanic or Satanist professor. And even so, like the president of the university that I work at, he's no longer the president, but at that time, he had to issue a statement of saying, like, yeah, I was offended by what he said, but he's protected under First Amendment rights, both for speech and religion. And then the religion thing kind of like threw me, and I was like, oh, this guy probably thinks I'm a devil worshiper. So that's cool. So I'm going to lean into that, and I am going to start doing actual research on Satanists and their mental health and stigma and sexuality. So I actually become the Satanist professor, in which MSU then would have to actually talk about me as a Satanist professor doing this research and presenting and publishing and all that. So that's the origin story. It was ultimately a goof on me because I didn't realize how good data we're going to get that we were going to get at the time. I thought it was going to just be a one-off kind of project, but it's been 5, 6 years now in the making with no end in sight. So it's a lot of work. It has been a lot of work, but it has yielded a lot of presentations and publications. And essentially with Satanists and their sexuality is that if we look at modern Satanism dating back to 1966 with the founding of the Church of Satan in San Francisco, they were as explicit pro-masturbation as you can get. And that's why I included it in the book, because it was such a contrast to the prohibitions and the major religions that I talk about, of like Catholicism and Mormonism, Judaism and Islam are like the big four that I discuss. And I wanted to kind of offset that. It's like, it's not just religion that's saying masturbation is bad. There are other religions that say masturbation is actually good. And I just included the Satanism one because that's my area of specialty right now. So that was easy to write. But it was also a nice parallel to a lot of the fear mongering, especially within Christianity, that they say and claim that masturbation is satanic and that it opens portals to the demonic world and demons will attach to you and Satan's whispering in your ear to get you to masturbate and all these things. So I wanted to kind of contrast that with like what do actual modern Satanists who actually don't believe in the devil? It's an atheistic religion. What do they actually say about masturbation? And if they kind of view it as, oh yeah, Christians consider that this is a sin, then let's embrace that. If masturbation is the work of the devil, then hail Satan. And that's essentially the attitude toward it is very permissive. It doesn't mean that you have to masturbate in order to be a good Satanist, but you're certainly given the liberty to if you desire.
It sounds like a healthier view of sexuality.
It is, yeah. And I think for the mainstream population to accept that their values and their attitudes align much better with Satanism than traditional forms of Christianity may not sit well with them, but that's certainly the reality.
Yeah, absolutely. And there are so many things that these people are opposed to. I mean, some of those arguments that you're talking about, like against masturbation, they're saying that about yoga. You know, like people are pushing back on yoga now with some really, truly bizarre ideas.
Right, for sure. Yeah. Anything that kind of violates their view of what God wants, and that includes kind of quote unquote like Eastern philosophies or Eastern practices. And so that would include any kind of yoga or even like non-denominationally based meditation. Again, it's all kind of like this belief into like you're opening you're like ripping the fabric of time or a dimension, and you're allowing demons into your life, and they're going to attach to you. Now, I grew up Catholic, so we didn't really get that kind of messaging. Catholicism for me as a kid was just like extremely boring. It didn't resonate at all. It was just something that we did, and it was just mind-numbing. But talking with a lot of evangelicals or those who grew up with kind of evangelical Christianity, all the things that they were prevented from doing as a kid, a concern that it was like the devil's work. And it was a whole list I think I included in a footnote in one of the chapters. I forget what I was mentioning, even, but it was things essentially like anything on Nickelodeon, Pokemon, Casper the Friendly Ghost, all these things were forbidden because they were believed to be entryways into the devil's work.
Wow, that must be really damaging for children.
Yeah, I would think that would, and once you become an adult and realize how silly that is, that's just not a light switch that's going to like flip of like, oh yeah, that was ridiculous. My parents were ridiculous for teaching me that, for prohibiting that. You're still going to feel that very much on an emotional level, and it's going to take time to really kind of shed that indoctrination.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, you know, not only religions, but mainstream society, I guess, has pushed back against masturbation increasingly since the 19th century. Now, you mentioned that several different people in this book who did have an effect on this. And of course, the first one is John Harvey Kellogg. So, who was Kellogg and what kind of effect did he have on this?
Yeah, Kellogg was an interesting dude. He was a physician in Battle Creek, Michigan, at a sanitarium at that time in the late 1800s. And he was really caught up with like the health and hygiene movement at the time, but w which was a common thing amongst these physicians who kind of adopted some of the very kooky beliefs about sexuality and had these bizarre cures for everything. And it wasn't just limited to masturbation, and they had bizarre cures for a lot of things. But what was definitely influencing his practicing of medicine as it relates to sexuality was his strong Christianity and his Christian values with that. And so that definitely clouded his view of what actually constitutes true healthy sexuality. And so he just viewed masturbation as a sin, and therefore it must be unhealthy for you. And so he attributed a whole host of diseases and disorders to being caused or as a consequence of masturbation. And he really was a proponent of a whole host of different interventions as a way to try to decrease masturbatory desire, as well as just decrease the behavioral act. And so behaviorally, he was even a proponent of like binding hands at night for children, putting them in chastity cages, using spiked rings around the penis to prevent erections, stuff like that, having parents spy on their kids as they're sleeping to look for evidence of nighttime masturbation, all of that. But in order to decrease the desire, he was a big proponent of like a bland diet. believing that a diet of that was rich and included like spicy foods kind of inflamed the body and increased his sexual desire in some way. So he was a proponent of doing the opposite of that, very bland. And the result of that was the development of a toasted cornflake. And so if you put the name together with the cornflake, that's essentially the origin story of Kellogg's cornflakes. And that story is about 95% true. The little bit that kind of gets missed with that is that Dr. Kellogg really wanted his cornflakes just to be used as a treatment within the walls of his sanitarium. It was actually his brother, Will, that wanted to take the patent for the cornflake and make it a company and sell it commercially as a cereal. And they were involved, the brothers were involved in a legal battle for about a decade with Will Kellogg, the brother, ultimately winning. And that's the then became the formation of the Kellogg's company that we know today.
That's absolutely amazing. Now, he thought that masturbation could cause all different kinds of, concerning side effects, but the one that stuck out to me was he thought that masturbating would make you like the taste of cinnamon.
Yeah, he was very fixated on spices. Again, that kind of goes into his belief that spices and rich foods increased sexual desire. But yeah, I don't. There's some speculation as to why he was kind of fixated on spices, and that it either if you ate spices or spicy types of food, that you would want to masturbate, as well as if you masturbated, then you would start enjoying the taste of different spices. There is some speculation that that had some racist origins of like believing that the cultures who rely more heavily on certain spices that, oh, they can't control their sexual desire. Look at quote unquote, those people. And so we need to do the opposite of that. It's like white Westerners. I couldn't really pinpoint that as being 100% accurate. So I left that out of my book. But that was the only thing that I could ever come across as to explain, like, what's this fixation that he has on spices? But yeah, I mean, fortunately for those of us who enjoy spices, yeah, masturbation is not going to have any impact on whether or not you enjoy the taste of cinnamon.
So, while we're ruining groceries for people, who was Sylvester Graham?
Sylvester Graham was probably my favorite to write about in the book, and I thought it was going to be Kellogg. That's why I let off the intro with him. But starting with Graham, it has a similar kind of vibe as Kellogg, and that's where we get Graham crackers from. He didn't invent them himself, but his disciples, so to speak, known as Grahamites, eventually did because he was a big proponent of a bland diet to try to just like calm the body down. But he was a reverend in New England in the early 1800s. And one of the books that I reference is A Lecture to Young Men on Chastity, or A Lecture on Chastity to Young Men, written, I think, in 1837. And in it, it really looks no different. Like I read the whole thing, and it really looks no different than just perusing WebMD. It's organized by bodily systems. And within each bodily system, let's say like the nervous system or digestive system, it just lists pretty much every ailment imaginable within that bodily system. And he's arguing that sexual behavior and orgasm, particularly from masturbation, is a cause or a consequence to all these diseases. And so it's everything. Some of my favorites include like bleeding from the mouth and tooth loss, spontaneous abortion, suicide, psychosis, cerebral hemorrhaging, violent belching, and whatever discharges from the anus, whatever he was referring to with that. So yeah, he was way out there and just believing that. What's interesting with Graham too, and I will say at least he was somewhat ideologically consistent with his bizarre beliefs about masturbation, because a lot of people will say that masturbation is harmful to your body, but penile vaginal intercourse is okay. And somehow your body knows the difference with that orgasm. But no, it's an orgasm is an orgasm. And Graham thought that way too, of like an orgasm is orgasm. And so he, even for married couples, really recommended like pumping the brakes on your sexual desire and the frequency of your sexual behavior to no more than like once a month, because he just believed an orgasm essentially was just too radical for your body to handle. And it just sent all bodily systems into disarray that opened you up to a whole host of diseases and disorders.
Wow. So the ideal there is the practice of semen retention, right? So where does this idea come from, and why do people think it's a good idea?
A little comes from a little bit of different places. I I focused more on kind of Western history and Western science with this book, but it certainly has origins beyond that, has origins in Taoism and Hinduism, of just viewing semen as like a vital fluid within your body, and that losing that vital fluid, you're also losing vital nutrients that are believed to be in that fluid. Now, for white Westerners, they've co-opted a lot of those Taoist beliefs and traditional Chinese medicine beliefs around semen retention into their own kind of weird spirituality, white Western kind of spirituality. So it has some origins there, but it's all rooted in masturbation shame. And so they're just looking for reasons to justify abstaining from masturbation. That's essentially the function of semen retention for them. They have discomfort with the idea of masturbation when they masturbate, if they give in to temptation, so to speak, and they feel guilt, shame, embarrassment, distress, something along those lines, and they try to abstain as long as possible. They need to justify that abstinence, right? And so even for the religious people, it's interesting that I found that threat of hellfire is not even really a good motivator for that. And I think maybe it's just too abstract. They lack enough faith, because you would think that, oh, if you masturbate, you're going to go to hell. That would be a good enough reason not to masturbate. But even for the faithful, oftentimes that isn't enough. So they have to find these like pseudoscientific, like health hucksterism kind of things that justify, like, no, it's actually going to be very bad for my body right now. Forget about eternity and my soul, but right now it's going to be damaging to my body. So that's why I need to avoid it. And so, yeah, it's really just this false belief that semen somehow is important for your body's health and well-being, and that ejaculating it out is doing damage. And it's not doing that at all. Again, unless you think it's doing damage, and then, yeah, you're going to feel pretty shitty after you masturbate, but it has nothing to do with actual seminal loss.
Now, I think you mentioned a study that shows that masturbation actually raises testosterone. Is that right?
Yes or no? I mean, there's some research that shows certainly a correlation between levels of testosterone and sexual drive. And so you can, but those are correlational. We have to be cautious with causation. There has been a few experimental studies that try to look at causation, but those are small samples. It's kind of difficult to get people to masturbate for the glory of scientific results, or abstain for the control group. So yeah, it's a little bit of a mixed bag, and certainly not enough to be conclusive. And that's kind of the argument too, that these semen retention advocates really kind of point to this one study that supposedly showed that abstaining for a week significantly increased your testosterone. And that study was later retracted. So it was a shitty study to begin with. Even if it wasn't retracted, it was only done with like a handful of people. And then you also had research that kind of suggested the opposite of that too, and that you saw increases in testosterone from masturbating and not abstaining. But the big thing to keep in mind, and kind of the and this is why doing research, so to speak, also requires understanding the research that you're doing. And you have to look at the bigger picture and the clinical implications for this. And so even if there are slight variations in testosterone as a result of sexual behavior, any sexual behavior, whether it's going up or going down, there's slight variations in our hormones all throughout the day. And the big thing is that all of these studies didn't include people who were actually hypogonadal, meaning that they had clinically low testosterone. And then they showed a clinically significant improvement as a result of either masturbating or not masturbating. The research doesn't show that at all. And we wouldn't expect to do that. If somebody actually had low testosterone to the point where they needed hormone replacement therapy in the form of like an injection or a topical gel, the recommendation from the endocrinologist or the urologist would never be, oh, just masturbate or abstain from masturbation, because that's not going to do anything to a clinically significant level, because all these guys are healthy to begin with. So it doesn't matter. And so it's not going to impact your testosterone in any way, up or down, to a level that you would actually notice.
Fascinating. So you also talk about Dr. Benjamin Rush. He was a Surgeon General in the Continental Army during the Revolutionary War, and he warned against masturbation addiction. He also had some tips to avoid it. Do you remember what any of those were?
Yeah, he was an interesting dude. I like that he was one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence. That was fun. So technically he's a founding father. And actually, you know, with some of these guys too, like with Sylvester Graham, he's hailed as kind of an innovator within promoting a vegetarian diet. Right. And so he was one of the first ones in America to really be a proponent of that. And Dr. Benjamin Rush was really considered an advocate for those experiencing mental illness and still is today. I mean, there's hospital systems, like there's one in Chicago named after him. He's on the seal of the American Psychiatric Association. So there's some things in which they were innovators, and we still view them that way today. But when it comes to like sex and specifically masturbation, they were just like way off base. So Rush, believing that masturbation was a problem, especially quote unquote too much, and doesn't really kind of quantify what that is. But he suggested a whole host of ways to try to distract yourself from not masturbating. And that can include going on long journeys by horseback, having a good laugh, studying mathematics for some reason. And coming right out of the Revolutionary War, he recommended going to war and experiencing military glory as a way to not masturbate. And then also not looking a woman directly in the face. So for some reason, all these reasons, doing the opposite or not doing that would increase the likelihood of masturbating. So making sure that you follow Dr. Rush's advice and get a horse and make sure to avoid eye contact with women.
Wow. Of course, the concept of masturbation addiction is itself controversial. So, what are the problems with diagnosing it, and how is it different from other types of addictions?
Yeah, so the big problem is, also, anytime I talk about masturbation, porn, or sex addiction, it's important for me to start off with the debate over whether or not it exists doesn't mean that people can't run into problems in their life because of their masturbation habits, because of their porn habits. No one debates that. We see it all the time in clinical work. That's a reality for people. The debate is more of a clinical and a scientific debate over, well, what's causing this problem? For these people who are having problems with it, what do we call the problem? And then how do we treat the problem? And those three things have to align because what we call it is really informed by what we think is causing it, right? And so we're not going to call it sex addiction if we don't think it actually has addictive mechanisms behind it, like what we see with like heroin dependence. We would call it something like sexual compulsivity if we think it's more driven by a compulsive kind of nature or compulsive problem. And then that will also determine how we treat it. And so by the problem by calling it sex addiction is that it assumes that masturbation is, and those who experience problems from their whatever type of masturbation habits that they have are stemming from like addictive kind of chemical processes in the brain that are similar to how our bodies respond to different types of substances. And therefore, treatment would look similar to substance and chemical dependency type of treatment, 12 steps, residential treatment facilities, things like that. And so that's largely the push right now within like the sex addiction, porn addiction, masturbation addiction model is that, yeah, it is no different than substance abuse and substance dependence. And therefore it needs this type of treatment, 12 steps, residential treatment facilities, things like that. The problem is there is no research to support that especially the treatment of any type of problematic sexual behavior as it relates to masturbation is effective. There's no research that shows like 12 steps, like Sexaholics Anonymous, or residential treatment facilities where you go away for like 30 days to 45 days and some type of retreat of abstinence, that has any impact long term on curbing your masturbation habits. So it's just not effective. And so we have to start questioning, like, well, what is actually the underlying mechanism here if it's not similar to addictive processes like we see with chemical dependency? And that's the problem because I think we're trying to label a phenomenon with one thing when it's actually could be caused by a whole host of different things that already have labels. It can be a side effect of or a symptom of a manic episode within bipolar disorder. It can be used for mood regulation because of an underlying anxiety or a depressive disorder. It can be part of ADHD. It can be part of neurocognitive disorders like dementia or another type of or Alzheimer's. So it can be a whole host of different things, and that's not going to really bode well for trying to reduce it down to a single label and a single treatment. And so that's the controversy over. Not that people don't struggle sometimes with their masturbation, but actually, why are they struggling?
Gosh, yeah, that's really interesting. Now, one of the things in the book that really surprised me was reading about the white supremacist opposition to porn and the weird conspiracy theories that they have around it. But as you mentioned, of course, the Nazis were opposed to it too. So I guess the question is, does masturbation fight fascism?
You could say that. Yeah. I mean, that's an Antifa strategy if you want to engage in. But yeah, I was not expecting to write about white supremacy in the book, but yeah, they take up a decent section, and I think I talk most about them within the porn section, I believe, because and maybe a little bit in the chapter before on addiction. Just because their beliefs are kind of are straddling that they're opposed to masturbation, but they're also opposed to porn. For the porn piece, there's this anti-Semitic conspiracy theory that white supremacists believe that Jews created porn in order to weaken white Christian men. And this is part of like their larger conspiracy theory of replacement theory or white genocide, that they're going to be bred out of the culture and they're going to be bred out through pornography. Because what they believe pornography does to guys is that they make them very docile and weak, and so they can be conquered, or they're not motivated to seek out relationships anymore. And then, therefore, because this is all part of conspiracy, Jewish men or non-white men, therefore, are going to procreate with white women and essentially breed white men out of the race. And so fascinating to me that one, that somebody thought this up, that this was actually believed, like, oh yeah, this is actually going on. They saw pornography and created this whole like web of conspiracy with it, but also is worried about this to the point of like taking time to write articles and books about this conspiracy theory of how Jews created porn to weaken white men and to essentially annihilate the white race in the West. It's like, all right. Sure, you can believe that. It doesn't mean it's true. And it also gets into the medical pseudoscience too, because of what they believe actually is happening to the body from watching pornography to masturbating, thinking that if we watch porn, we masturbate, that we're becoming so weakened that we can no longer pursue relationships, we can no longer fight off encroaching armies, and we're just going to be taken over by whoever is the dominant class who is looking to use porn as a weapon. And so just kind of very bizarre thinking, both on a racist level and a pseudoscience level.
Wow. And then of course there's the issue of how do you define porn, right? And every day online, I'm sure you're seeing this too. We're seeing people trying to redefine porn. What is it? Is it actually just kind of nude photos? Is it fan fiction? Is it romance novels? Is it books for kids that feature two moms? Or like Hallie Lieberman said on our show the other day, is it dictionaries in Florida, right? So why is it dangerous to classify everything as pornographic? And where can this possibly go?
I mean, the danger here is because it's then it makes it easy to regulate and to regulate, to restrict, to censor. And we're seeing that definitely today with all these different bills that are being introduced to try to protect the children. It's always under that guise of, protect kids. This stuff is going to be harmful to minors. And on the surface, what it looks like they're doing is noble and worthwhile to kind of at least to explore to see if there is some type of regulatory avenue that can be explored to better protect people online. But how the bills are written are so vague that pretty much everything can come up under the definition of pornography. And so you're not just looking at removing harmful things of, depictions of people that did not consent to their image being taken, let alone being posted and shared online, that we write a bill to try to address that issue. Meanwhile, that bill is written in a way that it's essentially banning all pornography online. And you have to question whether or not the writers of these bills actually know that, in which I think they do, because their issue is more with pornography in general, of what they think is a harm or a societal ill that they want and ideally would just want eliminated from our culture altogether. But they have to package it in a way that seems to be just targeted at a particular problem. But they're not using a scalpel to deal with that particular problem. They're using a broad, like, crusader sword, and it's going to have a lot of negative implications for the sex industry as a whole.
Yeah, absolutely. But is there any real evidence that porn is actually harmful?
Not to the extent that people claim. So there are whole websites devoted to this, trying to convince you how awful porn is. I talk about in the book, Fight the New Drug, as just one example. There are a dime a dozen. I just pointed them out as one that I had come across early on in my research. Yeah, making all these claims that porn is going to destroy your relationships, porn kills love. That's where that slogan comes from this group. porn causes brain damage, all these things. And they claim not to be coming from a place of religious values and proselytizing, and also that they're not looking to legislate pornography, that they are just informing the public that porn can be harmful to you, and so stay away. But if you start looking a little bit under the surface of how Fight the New Drug, for example, was formed, it was formed by essentially a Mormon theocrat who would definitely like to see his own religious values reflected in legislation. And so, even though they're not explicitly saying that on their website, you could easily see kind of through the lines of the motivation behind it and where this is coming from. Because they try to just keep it grounded in the science, and they have these articles, and they're the well cited with all these different links to articles that supposedly back up their claims. But it's a big smoke and mirrors show. And so, I think that one of the examples I gave in my book about how porn causes brain damage. In one of their articles, I think they cited 36 references. Well, if you look at that, most of the references are duplicates of one another. And so I think they just had 13 original citations. And then of those, I think it was only four that actually dealt with pornography in the brain. And they were all correlational studies. So nothing really indicating cause and effect. And if you look at the studies themselves, they're not even really saying what these anti-porn groups are believing that that they're saying. And so again, the whether they know this and they're just being manipulative and they're intentionally spreading misinformation, even disinformation about this, or they're just completely scientifically illiterate and they actually do believe the research that they're citing is saying what they're saying, I don't know. But the research doesn't support that we can say definitively and conclusively that porn is going to hurt you in X, Y, and Z. Now, other than what I said earlier, that the nuance to that is if you have beliefs that porn is harmful and that you shouldn't be watching it, but you do it anyways, yeah, that's not going to be the greatest for you. You're going to feel distress afterwards and can cause problems, going to lead to a lot of secrecy. Secrecy can breed problems for you. If you're in a relationship that prohibits it and you get caught, yeah, that's going to be a relationship conflict. And so that's where porn kills love or porn kills relationships actually comes from. It's that porn is violating a value system that exists in the relationship, whereas another relationship has a different value system, watching the same amount of pornography has no impact on their life or their relationship whatsoever. And so, therefore, it's not killing love, it's not killing the relationship or the marriage.
Yeah, so much of it seems to come from this this sense of shame that they just kind of assume that everybody has.
Yeah, again, I think it's just trying to justify their own shame, their own guilt, their own just not feeling great about masturbation and thinking that it is a problem, at least like maybe just spiritually, they think it's a problem, something that you shouldn't be doing because it goes against God's plan or whatever. But and they want more kind of concrete material data to support that belief, to justify why they feel so uncomfortable. And I think that's when they start scrambling to find studies that supposedly back up their claims to be like, no, this has nothing to do with my spirituality or my beliefs or my feelings. This is just medical fact. And it's not medical fact. It is just about your feelings. But ironically, it can become medical fact because of your feelings.
Wow. And of course, people have been arguing against masturbation for all different kinds of, kind of made up health reasons for a very long time. And I know we've already talked about a few of them. But also in the book you mentioned in 1875, Dr. Emory Abbey argued that masturbation could lead to an early death. I mean,
Yeah.
that seems kind of extreme, but what was his reasoning there?
Just that it ages the body. He wasn't too unique in that. I think Graham talked about that. Even Kellogg talked about that. They all believe that masturbation was so detrimental to your body, it's going to lead to premature aging and a premature grave. He was just pretty a little bit more explicit about it. In his book, The Sexual Systems and Their Derangements, he included some photos in there that supposedly showed, I forget the specific ages of it, but it was supposed to be like a 70-year-old abstainer and a 50-year-old masturbator. And the 50-year-old masturbator looked all decrepit and hunched over, using a cane, a straggly beard. And the 70-year-old abstainer looked very, sitting up straight or standing up straight, looked very pious and very healthy. And so just trying to make the argument that, yeah, if you want to have a long, healthy life, you need to abstain from masturbation. And obviously, there's no medical support for that, for what's for any reason that Emery was trying to make. He did interest all these people had some very interesting language in it, and with Dr. Abbey specifically, just to quote him of what he thinks happens to a masturbator, that the masturbator after masturbating would put them into a premature grave loaded with violent forms of disease, with debasement of the human soul and the mind filled with obscenity and beastliness. So they're pretty poetic in their writing too. I mean, they paint a very vivid picture of what's going to happen to you if you succumb to the temptation of touching your own genitals. So I can imagine how like convincing it was in the 1800s and why it still is very convincing today when you go on to like a NoFap, subreddit and see people saying pretty much the same thing just in modern language. And if you have this belief, or at least kind of on the fence of not knowing whether or not masturbation is healthy for you, that can be pretty convincing, and it's a scare tactic that can work for a lot of people.
Wow. And so much of this, it just strikes you like how much really doesn't change. Of course you talk about these NoFap sites and ideas like No Nut November. But then on the other side you also have things like jack-off societies, right? And like I mean these have actually existed for centuries. Like we featured on the blog, someone wrote an article for us about this group called Beggars Benison in early modern Scotland. I'm sure you came across them. But this group of men would like get together and like basically jack off onto this like communal plate, and it was just like part of their kind of annual meetings or whatever. So it's so interesting that this stuff has just been around forever, both, people who are in favor of it, but then also like the people who are opposed kind of for the same reasons. Do you think that we'll ever be able to settle this argument?
No, I don't think so. Maybe that's just my pessimism. I don't know. As I say in the book, like sexual progressiveness is like two orgasms forward, one orgasm back. It's not a linear process. And so I think right now we're definitely in an orgasm back stage. Definitely compared to like the spirit of the 1960s and 70s, in which like Betty Dodson was starting her masturbation groups and like writing Masturbation Liberation. We just don't really have that kind of spirit right now. And at best, we're just trying to fight back against like misinformation and disinformation online from some of these weirdo groups. But yeah, that was one of the biggest surprises to me writing this book is how similar the past is to today, especially with the prohibitions. The language is updated, but essentially their beliefs are exactly the same, that they think masturbation is harmful and it's going to do all these different types of damages to your body. And for the reasons are very similar too, because it's I originally wanted to write the book without even mentioning gender, because I was like, okay, this is a book about masturbation. We can talk about body parts and we can talk about behavior. But I quickly learned that was going to be impossible because the history of masturbation prohibition is so gendered, and a lot of the research is kind of divided amongst genders too. And so that became an impossible feat. But what we realize is that the belief that masturbation challenges very strict traditional gender norms for all genders, really was a huge driver of masturbation prohibition attitudes 200, 300 years ago. And it's the same driver today. It really comes down to that masturbation violates a lot of what we expect people to do with their own bodies as it relates to sexuality, and that it shouldn't be just for ourselves. It should be expressed to a partner, and that the fact that we're doing it for ourselves, are we a real man for doing that, because we should be doing this with a woman. Am I a good enough, a feminine enough woman for masturbating, or am I quote unquote desensitizing or ruining my body for a man one day, right? So a lot of these ridiculous beliefs that are very sexist, that's what was driving it 200, 300 years ago, but it's still a main driver of anti-masturbation attitudes today.
Gosh, it's sad. But let's see if
It
we can
is.
settle this once and for all. Is masturbation bad for you?
No, on a physical level, in and of itself, no, it's not gonna be a cause or consequence or anything. So I tried to end the book a little bit on a kind of a taking a step back and just be like, because doing the research with this and just seeing the outrage that people have about masturbation and promoting masturbation and what they believe it does to your body, I'm thinking just on a common sense level, like you don't have to have a degree in masturbatory science, if that actually existed, to know that masturbation is just a moment of pleasure. And that's it. It doesn't have to be anything more than that, both positive and negative, because in the conclusion of the book, I kind of get, I'm a little critical of some sex educators touting masturbation as kind of like this cure-all for a lot of different things. And so I push back a little against that. But ultimately, it comes down to masturbation is just a moment of pleasure with very, very little cause or consequence beyond just experiencing pleasure in that moment.
Fantastic. So this book is so great. I would absolutely recommend it to anybody. So what is next for you? How do you follow this?
I don't know. I'm just focused on promotion of this book right now. I'm recording the audio for it soon, so there will be an audiobook version, which I am dreading. I do not like speaking off of a script. I'm having flashbacks to when we had to read aloud in class in like third grade from the textbook. That's going to be a kind of a stressful process. But beyond that, I am looking eventually to do some type of audiovisual media with this book, like television movie rights, for a docu-series, documentary, something along those lines, where I would just write it into that format. But I can definitely see this being visually presented more than what I could do with the book. So
Oh,
that's on the
absolutely.
horizon. And yeah, that's really all what I'm kind of focused on right now.
Well, I think that sounds great, and I'll really look forward to that. So, where can we find more about you and your important work?
I am on different social media like Instagram, Twitter, and Threads at Dr. Sprankle, and my website, drsprankle.com. You can kind of keep up with what I'm doing there. Definitely links to all the different types of formats of the book. I have signed copies through some distributors and signed through others. So all the links are at those sites.
Okay, wonderful. Well, thank you so much for being our guest today. We cannot thank you enough. You've been amazing.
Thanks for having me.
Once again, I'd like to thank Dr. Eric Sprankle for being our guest today. His new book is DIY, The Wonderfully Weird History and Science of Masturbation, and it's out on Tuesday. I'd also like to thank our superstar patrons on Patreon, Melanie Baker, Michael Beckwith, Bethany Bennett, Andy Christopher, Charlotte Collings, Rachel Cooney, Michelle Dunbar, James Finch, Brian Fullerton, Adriana Herrera, Sean Ingham, Emma Young, Miriam Caceres, Kirsten Lawrence, Scott Lohman, Lizzie Ortmeier, Shannon Roth, Catherine Rowley Williams, Icy Sedgwick, and Denny White. Thank you all so much. If you would like to support the show by becoming a patron, you can find us on patreon.com/dirtysexyhistory. You can also rate, review, and subscribe, or find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Mastodon, and Blue Sky at Dirty Sexy History. As always, check out our website for longer history articles on dirtysexyhistory.com. Have a great week, guys. See you next time.